This entire project actually started from one question that I've been sitting on for a few years now. How come I'm a genius in the shower? Seriously, why is it that hopping into the shower results in this absurdly long list of ideas or plans that I want to explore? So I did what any millennial would do, pulled out my smartphone and Googled, good ideas in the shower? Question mark. I skimmed the results and landed on a general conclusion that not only made complete sense, but also worried me. These bursts of creativity were being limited to just a few minutes a day, because my shower forced me to pay attention to the one thing that the rest of my daily world works so hard to distract me from. Myself. I want to preface my findings with this. Technology is not evil. It's not the enemy or the Antichrist or what have you. In fact, technology has created possibilities for connection, creativity, and ingenuity in ways that benefits all of mankind. It's my hope that this podcast will help raise awareness of the role devices play in our lives, their impact on our attention, and how we can learn to live in harmony with our devices, rather than in spite of them.
Most of us know that feeling of like, you eat one potato chip and it's really good. You know, it's salty and greasy. It's just perfect.
That's Jeff Goodman, professor of media studies at Appalachian State University and personal hero.
But as soon as you swallow it, you reach for the next potato chip. You don't just eat one potato chip. And it's hard to know when to even stop because you're never really full of potato chips. You get a little nauseated eventually, but you don't really get full of potato chips. And that's a similar thing to what happens with screens, I think, is that we never feel full. We always feel like we want one more, and we always feel just a little bit nauseated, psychically or spiritually nauseated.
People, specifically young people, check their phones on average 150 times a day. What's even more terrifying is that we underestimate how much we check our phones by half. In a world of Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, emails, texts, calls, and FaceTime, a single pop-up notification is all it takes for our device to seize our attention. Each ping triggers a hit of dopamine to the prefrontal cortex of the brain, a literal chemical reaction that feels good. We pick up our phones, cycle through our apps, and seek out the next ping or This is exactly why the rhetoric surrounding device use mimics that of drug addiction. I'm addicted to my phone. I can't put it down. I want to stop.
It's scary. Because it's scary, and I say, it's not like, oh, I'm so scared about the world, all those other suckers out there. I'm scared about what's happening to the next generation. I'm scared what's happening to me.
I sat down with a member of Generation Z, often referred to as Generation Net, as they're the only ones who cannot recall a time in their life without the internet. This is Grace, a junior in high school.
When I'm really bored, like on a snow day or something, I'll get on Instagram too many times and I'll just keep refreshing and like nobody's gonna post every second of the day, so.
I asked her later why she feels like she has to keep refreshing her feeds all the time. And she told me that she honestly just didn't want to miss an important post from one of her friends. This is the crux of this generation and their devices. They are constantly juggling the desire to know everything about the lives of their peers and a crippling anxiety of being out of the loop, resulting in compulsive overuse. And it starts even younger than this. Here's Sid, age 10.
A lot of kids my age, I know they like have Snapchat account, like Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, like all of social media. And they talk about me and so-and-so were texting all night.
Why do you think people are so obsessed with it?
Because so many people do it, they don't want to be left out. They want to be the cool kids who have phones.
Gen Z is the perfect model of what writer Linda Stone refers to as continuous partial attention. It's the idea that in our attempt to be constantly connected and constantly connecting, we're in fact dividing our attention among so many things that no thing, no one, earns our full attention. We aren't diving deep. We're skimming the surface. And we aren't paying attention to each other, to the world, and to ourselves. Okay, back to my shower genius question. The inside of my shower is one of the only, if not the only place, my phone will never see. You can't. It'll get wet. It's sad that that's the reality, but it's an incubator from devices, distractions, and limitations. It's like a breath of fresh air for my mind, and I'm not alone. Cognitive psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman found that 72% of people around the globe reported experiencing new ideas in the shower. How come? When our brains are left to wander, they enter a state referred to as the default mode network, or sometimes, more playfully, the imagination network. It's during this process that the brain engages in autobiographical mapping, a process that allows us to construct and reflect on our sense of self and plan for the future. In other words, the more time we spend with just our thoughts, the more in tune we are with who we are. Taking it a step further, when we understand ourselves, we're more readily available to understand others. We're able to show more empathy, compassion, and understanding. So, what happens when the moment our brains are given a free moment to breathe, to wander, to dream, to reflect, we instead compulsively fill the silence with a screen? In one study, 77% of 18 to 24-year-olds reported that they reach for their phones before doing anything else when nothing's going on. But how is this behavior impacting our relationship with ourselves and with others? Here's Sid.
A lot of the kids that I know that have phones, they... Another thing I don't want to stereotype, but a lot of times they're not very nice to me and my friends because... I don't know if that's just because they're unstable or what, but... And I think they disrespect the teachers a lot because... Maybe because they want to spend time on their phone or something like that.
And here's Grace.
One person's mad at someone and they want to get back at them. They'll invite like all their friends out and post pictures and stuff, and then so that one person will see it. And I think that's awful. I hate it. I hate being left out like that. It's annoying when you're at dinner and you're not on their phone, but the other person is on their phone and you want to have a conversation, but you know they won't listen. So you're just sitting there waiting for them to get off their phone and then they don't. I'm not trying to tell a joke, but you're on your phone.
It would be a stretch to say that our devices are making us soulless monsters. It would not, however, be a stretch to say that they're very good at seizing our attention, only to scatter it. It's borrowing time from the interpersonal work that's necessary in order to empathize and connect with other human beings. Our devices are merely short-circuiting our priorities and values, but not altering them.
We're so easily, intrigued by the little boop that comes on our phone or the little buzz that we're willing to kill off the people around us in these tiny slow deaths, which is like, I'm not going to pay attention to you for this 15 seconds while I answer this email. And it's really like, it's like, okay, I'm going to kill you for 15 seconds.
I love my mom. I value our time together. I care about what she has to say. And yet I'll find myself scrolling through Twitter when she speaks to me. For what? At the end of the day, our devices are tools. If we aren't using them, then we're going to be used by them. Because that's what they're designed to do. The paychecks of app designers depend on how much time we spend on their programs. But they aren't the enemy. There's no enemy here. It comes down to a question of our values. What do we prioritize in our lives? And what do we choose to leave on the back burner?
Do you want to be doing the things that you're doing if it means being closer to death at the end of them? Well, gosh, that's true of everything you're doing. And if I pick up my phone and I go to whatever, is that what I want to be doing with the little bit of time I have between now and death?
Yeah, remember that one when you try reaching for your phone.
Technology is often about disconnecting us, right? We don't need any more video or podcasts or photographs. We need more people who pay attention, to what's in their heart, who pay attention to the people around them, the real people around them who share food and breathe in the same air and are actually present with one another. And we need connection to the physical world. You need to find your way into a relationship with the things around you, despite the fact that the relationships that are calling the loudest right now tend to be relationships that are on your phone and on your computer.
Attention. Who deserves our attention? What gets our attention? All of it? Some of it? The average human attention span dropped from 12 to 8 seconds since the dawn of technology as we know it today.
The heart of it for me is attention. And that is, attention and appreciation are the precursors to creativity. It's a collaboration with the world. And to collaborate with the world, you have to start by, you know, loving it or being intrigued by it. And it doesn't have to be the thing that's most obviously beautiful. You know, sunlight on a turd can be a very beautiful thing, right? and just the act of paying attention is a creative act. You are co-creating the world with your own imagination when you look at it carefully. And you kind of bring its magic into being through your mindset. So that's the heart of creativity. You don't even need to make anything.
This moment of Jeff's curiosity paints a pretty powerful picture.
Do you think our conversation in here would have been different if we had been in the dark?
Yes. What would be different about it?
I don't know. Can we turn the lights up? I'm going to put my hat over the... Yay, now. Okay, so now it's really pretty dark in here.
It is super dark.
And
I'm listening to my voice so much closer now.
I know.
I wasn't even paying attention at all. It's suddenly so much quieter. It isn't, but it is.
That is so weird. I'm having that exact same experience.
It's really strange.
Wow.
It's like I wasn't listening to the silence at all. And now it's really quiet.
Yeah. And see.
And I'm not looking at my notes.
And this is so analogous to... So let me try an analogy. So the cell phone is like the lights. That is, it brightens stuff up so much that it distracts you from something else that's going on. And when you take it away, suddenly...
Okay, back again to my shower question. Perhaps the shower has unintentionally become my sacred place, where I pay no attention to a screen and pay 100% attention to myself. This way, my mind's able to wander, question, ponder, dream, and create. But the entire world is not an incubator like my shower. Distractions are always at my fingertips. But trying to eliminate technology completely would be similar to telling yourself, I'm not going to eat those potato chips. The more you tell yourself that you won't do something, the closer it will be to the forefront of your mind. Instead, start by doing this.
So there's an idea that I think it's Wittgenstein originally wrote about, that where he says, you can do what you want, but you can't want what you want. Now, what he means by that is that you have free will to do what you want. But if you say, I want to be the kind of person who wants to go for a walk after dinner, but I'm not the kind of person who wants to go for a walk after dinner. I can't make myself be the kind of person who wants that. You can't like have the secondary want to something. Although I don't agree with it, and I'll tell you why. And this is a key to my dealing with technology. So... if you ally something that you want to something that you actually want. So in my example of going for a walk after dinner, when I moved my chickens down to my garden, which was about a half mile from my house, I allied my desire to take a walk, which is something I wanted to do. I didn't actually want to do, to something that I really wanted, which is to keep my chickens safe. That's a natural thing. I don't have to work at that at all. Then I took the walk.
If you want to be the kind of person who doesn't sit on their phone at a meal, Make a game out of it. The phone stack game originated from a grad student who was fed up with her friends texting at meals. Pile your phones in the middle of the table, and the first person to cave into a boop pays for the whole meal.
You know, here's the thing. What if when you were on the phone, because we're going to be on our phones, you know, and later today we'll be looking stuff up or doing whatever. What if we tried every time we were on the phone or on a computer to bring curiosity to what we were doing? So, like, let's say you're looking at Instagram, and instead of just having the response to, like, the emotional hit, that's cool, that's beautiful, that I wish I was that person, I wish my life was that, I wish I had taken that photo, whatever all the things that you might feel. Like, what if you were to ask yourself some question, ask some question about the thing? You made yourself ask a question. What if there were another thing other than, like, what would I want? What word would I want to put? What if I could hit the pudding button?
There are simple ways to take control of our relationship with our devices. And no one said this was going to be easy. It's a learning experience. It's not going to happen overnight either. It's going to take work.
We have to be practicing, like, and pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone a little bit. And being honest with ourselves that we are falling into habits and, you know, like, or that our kids are or whatever. I think it's a lot of work, but people have to practice being with other people. I've been pretty negative about technology or about how hard it's going to be and how hard we have to work. But on the other hand, I have a great optimism about human resilience and about, I don't want to be a Pollyanna about it because I think there are really big deals going on. But when I meet my students and we have experiences together, semester after semester, great stuff happens when human beings get together and they give themselves the opportunity to play and they give themselves the opportunity to create. And they tap into their ancient desire to be in community. And they tap into their ancient desire to connect to the physical world and the smell of spring and the look of rain falling into a puddle. And they tap into their ancient desire to figure out what's in their heart and what they're curious about and what they have questions about. Over and over, my students find their way back to that if given the circumstances. And people can say, oh, I want more of that. That feels really good. That feels like real food, not potato chips.
Dr. Teresa Redman, media maker, professor of media studies, and mother of two.
In other words, learning doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens when people come together and they tackle hard problems. You know, what if you wanted to know the size of Jupiter? And you just go to your phone and, oh, there it is, the size of Jupiter. And it kind of stunts a natural curiosity that people have. And we definitely see young people have this. I have a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old, and they're both just ravenous to learn more about the world. And we do see a bit of this dulling. And I don't necessarily think it's actually dulled. I think as young people go through the school system, you know, information becomes kind of the golden ticket. You have it or you don't. And the process becomes less important. That when you say, wait a second, let's not look at Google. Let's not let the wonder kill our curiosity. Let's explore this. Let's talk about this. Well, you might find yourselves going down a twisting, turning conversation path where you learn more about each other's people and about your own interests. Like maybe you're sitting around your dorm room and you wanted to know what the size of Jupiter was, and you find out that one of your roommates was actually really interested in chemistry. And why didn't they pursue chemistry? Well, maybe they're female, and maybe it's part of that whole see Jane, we don't see women in roles of science. Science, technology, engineering, and math, and then you get in a conversation about media, and then maybe you want to change.
Dr. Redman brings it right back to the kids. What we want for ourselves and what we want for them.
I was really nervous and afraid of how to tackle issues of technology addiction or over-reliance or engagement with my kids. And what I've found is really simple. John and I, my partner, aren't on our phones a lot. And so our kids aren't.
I just think we're on our phones way too much and we don't take advantage of like the outdoors and family time, and especially family time. My friends, they do not understand quality family time, and it annoys me because like your family's not going to always be there for you, so you need to take advantage.
So now as adults, we have to set up circumstances where, again, the things that we want him to want are allied to the things that he actually wants. He actually wants connections with his parents. So if you want your kid to want to be in the physical world, continue to do that in the face of all the technology, you have to ally it to hanging out with him. Cook, I want to cook with him, bake bread. Ooh, kneading bread, right? Making pasta. He's with grandpa, and when grandpa Jeff, and he always make a mess, but then we eat it. It's like, I want to build a fort with him, and I can't wait to plant seeds with him, and I can't wait to play Legos with him, and I can't wait to maybe teach him how to program a Lego robot. I'm not going to like say, oh, because it's technology, it's bad, but the most important part of all those sentences was the with him part.
By the time we're whatever our average life is, like 75, 80 years old, we will have spent 11 years looking at a phone. That's more than your life so far.
Whoa. Yeah, that's... Wow.
Do you think you'll be one of those?
I don't know. I don't know. It depends on the kind of person that I turn out to be. I want to be the person that, like, pays attention in class. But I don't know. I just don't know yet.
Attention, connection, creativity. Why do they matter?
Why is being creative important to you?
I like being able to just go in any direction. There aren't any boundaries. It's everything that you are is your creativity. It's everything that you've experienced.
Oh, that ties into something you were making me think about my dad, and about how there's a way in which when I'm being creative, I'm honoring some people in my past, my friend Vince also, who died very young of Lou Gehrig's disease. And that there's a way in which by not sticking to the path and allowing myself to explore the edges, I can invoke the patterns that my dad and my friend Vince and others left in me. So if I just go by what is just the standard way of saying, you know, I like that, that's good, you know, just all the standard ways of talking, I am not honoring these specific people who left specific traces in my psyche, specific ways of thinking and joys and humor in my psyche. And when I am creative, I feel like I'm allowing them to speak through me, whether or not they would have said the exact thing. It's their imprint on me which says pudding, instead of I'm great.
And in that way, they're living on in anything that you create.
Yeah.
And do.
They're in this conversation. My friend Vince, he didn't go to college originally. His people in his family hadn't much gone to college. And so went off to college, and he did some community college classes, and he was being a mechanic, and he was working, kind of doing sculpture and various things and sort of teaching himself things. And he came when I was a senior in college to the apartment I lived in, the house I lived in with some friends, and we were all getting ready to graduate, and everybody's writing their senior thesis and you know, being so full of themselves about, you know, how great they were. And he showed up. One thing, he came in a car that he had taken all the seats out of and the dashboard off of, and so it was just like a boil of wires, you know, where the dashboard was, and you started it by shorting it out with a screwdriver, and he filled the car up with sticks and rocks and moss because he wanted to feel like what it would feel like to be outdoors. He had one driver's seat, but the rest was all just outdoor stuff, big boulders and, you know, and moss draped over like the back. And he said, yeah, I wanted to like feel like driving a long distance. You were outdoors kind of. And then one morning we're sitting at breakfast and we're drinking some juice, and on the label of the juice it says the ingredients, and it says cochineal is one of the ingredients. He's like, what's cochineal? We're like, we don't know what cochineal is. And you know, it's like, come on, you college kids, you know, like, what's cochineal? And so, did anybody have a dictionary? So he goes and gets a dictionary and he looks it up, and it turns out cochineal is an extract from a beetle. He's like, wait a minute, this is like, you know, vegetarians can't drink this juice. It's a colorant, it turns out, that they use to make juice, like orange, pinkish, I think. Yeah. And but it's from a beetle. He's like, vegetarians can't drink this juice. And I remember my friends looking at me and they're like, who is this guy? We've been to 4 years of this private college, and you know, and here he's been to two community college classes or something, and he's smarter and more curious than anybody we know at this whole university. He's like amazing. Anyway, he went on to get, you know, to work in math and philosophy, and he was working towards his undergrad when he got sick, and he died at 30, or 31 of Lou Gehrig's disease. And so I kind of owe it to him to like push the boundaries of my own thinking. So there's an example of like where might be hard to put my phone away and think something brand new, be bored for a little bit and then have an idea. But I have to do that to honor him. And he's here today with you.
He's
in this room
here
with my dad. And you know, my dad is with your grandparents, you know, or all the people who have informed you, you know. My dad, and your dad, and Vince are all hanging out and in this room, in this conversation, in the dark.
So, the world can't be our shower. But we can put ourselves into situations, and we can mindfully give our full attention to the things, ideas, and people that align with what we value, what we care about. So, maybe the next time you hear a think instead about what you stand to lose. A conversation never had, an idea never thought of, a connection never made, a dream never supported, or a person's life never honored. Instead, why don't you look up? Thank you a million times over to the wonderful Jeff Goodman, Dr. Teresa Redman, and Grace and Sid for their young wisdom. Thank you to Dr. Janice Pope and Megan Hayes for supporting me all along the way. And one last huge thanks to Dave Blanks. Literally couldn't have put this together without you. I'm Liz Pope, and thank you, listener, for your attention.